July 22nd. Poor Mrs. Brown, in trouble with the woman's club. She was so distracted today, she had to call Mr. Gold back twice to get instructions about mailing the motion picture contract. She seems to think these women mean to throw her in a cauldron of bouillon. As one of three members of the cultural committee, she was not the lone perpetrator, but it was her idea to involve the children. Their speaker was a girl named Surya, spending the summer with Asheville relatives, on leave from some school-term cultural exchange in Washington, D.C. It was Genevieve Kohler, neighbor to the relatives, who hatched the plot to have this girl from Russia as their cultural evening speaker. The ladies were in a jam. Decorating with the new plastic fabrics had canceled on short notice. Mrs. Brown thought of inviting local high school girls, pointing it up as an inspirational talk. The girl had lived through war. She had overcome long odds to arrive in Carolina in time for a rhododendron festival. Mrs. Brown said she looked as hale as a milkmaid, with brown eyes and dimples, and that the talk was both informative and audible. Little Surya spoke of her school in Russia, the free health program, and the Russian plan for old age care. She contrasted the governing bodies in her country with the newly elected communist government of Poland. She made favorable mention of the position of women in modern-day Russia, and equally favorable mention of North Carolina and Washington, D.C. Mrs. Brown said the girl was so unsophisticated and gracious, she doubted the child would have disparaged a spider had it walked across her face. Yet she created a sensation. The Woman's Club president, vice president, and sergeant-at-arms stood up as a block, interrupted the speaker to announce their devotion to America, and walked out. Some others followed. Mothers who had brought their girls, responding to the handbill distributed at school, left with daughters in tow, indignant at having been duped. "We did not mislead," Mrs. Brown insists. "We put on the handbill. She was here in the Youth Foreign Exchange from the former St. Petersburg." "Maybe they thought you meant St. Petersburg, the Republic of Florida, just across the waters from the Mexican continent, as I recall."
"Mr. Shepherd, this is not a joking matter."
"I'm trying to lighten your mood. It's not the disaster you think." The Asheville Trumpet, July 23, 1947. Crowd Takes Stand Against Reds, by Edwina Boudreau. Every nation must choose between alternative ways of life, according to President Truman, and the Woman's Club Cultural Evening on Monday was no exception. Tickets sold for 25 cents each for a cultural lecture by Miss Surya Poldava of the USSR. Mrs. Herb Luthridge, president, opened with the Pledge of Allegiance. The evening was interrupted by audience disagreement and brought to a hasty conclusion. Pastor Case Mabry of Cox First Baptist led the closing prayer. Mrs. Luthridge had no knowledge of the speaker and apologizes to each and every person in attendance. She said, "The Woman's Club opposes the suppression of personal freedoms and communistic way of life." Superintendent of Schools Ron Stanley called a meeting yesterday to discuss an occurrence that, he said, shocked the school system. "The nature of this assembly was repugnant to all who work with youth in Buncombe County," said Stanley, who did not attend the lecture, but said, "It runs contrary to the philosophy of education we operate under." The Asheville DAR, speaking through Mrs. Talmadge Rich, President General, not in attendance, also went on record as opposing the lecture. "The Woman's Club will review its guidelines to prevent the unfortunate occurrence in the future." The program was organized by Mrs. Glenn Kohler of Haywood and Mrs. Violet Brown of Tunnel Road. Reached by telephone, Mrs. Kohler gave her occupation as housewife and apologized for the turn of events. Mrs. Brown,
a secretary for a private firm, maintained the program was informative. She said, "The world has people of all kinds, and I don't see the good of wrapping our children's heads in cotton wool." Brown, age 47, is a childless widow. The Woman's Club will refund the ticket price to all who attended. August 15, 1947. Harrison W. Shepherd, 30 Montford Avenue, Asheville, North Carolina. Dear Mr. Shepherd, the Federal Bureau of Investigation has been charged by the Congress of the United States with the conduct of routine investigations of all persons presently or previously employed by the federal government in an effort to ascertain complete and unswerving loyalty to the United States. For this purpose, we request that you immediately supply in writing the following information: all former places of residence and former employers, schools and colleges attended, organizations, associations and groups in which the employee has been a member. This investigation is directed by the House Committee on Un-American Activities, formerly known as DIES Committee, and shall include reference to Civil Service Commission files, military and naval intelligence records, DIES Committee hearings of other employees when applicable, and local law enforcement files. Any derogatory information will result in a full field investigation. The Civil Service Commission maintains a master index covering all persons who have been subject to loyalty investigations since September 1, 1939. The Loyalty Review Board of North Carolina shall be furnished the name of any individual found to have associated with such persons, or with any organization, movement, or group the Attorney General has designated as totalitarian, fascist, communist, or subversive, or advocating acts of force or violence, or seeking to alter the form of government of the United States by unconstitutional means. The Review Board shall also be furnished with any evidence of sabotage, espionage, treason, sedition, or knowingly associating with spies. The McCormick Registration Act, Statute 631, requires that every person who is an agent of a foreign principal shall register with the Secretary of State. The Voorhees Act, Statute 1201, requires that every organization subject to foreign control which engages in political activity shall be required to register with the Attorney General. This Bureau expects your full and prompt cooperation in this investigation. Sincerely, J. Edgar Hoover, Director, Federal Bureau of Investigation. September 2nd. Arthur Gold in person looks like a Dashiell Hammett private eye. White shirt, rolled up sleeves, steel blue eyes, necktie 5 years out of date. He's a regular white-haired Sam Spade, complete with the smoky little office up a narrow flight of stairs in the Woolworths building on Henry Street. The ever-burning cigarette, the epic slouch. If Violet Brown is the do-be gal for posture, Mr. Gold is the don't-be. His narrow body describes the shape of an S in his chair, with a meridian running through the head, navel, and shins, with all else slumped to the fore or the aft. It was hard at first to reconcile the slumped posture with the astute voice on the telephone. But within minutes he established himself as the same Mr. Gold, planking out the long sentences that arrive unfailingly at their destination. He could be formidable in court, except midway between his subject and object, you'd become distracted by the cigarette, wondering when that worm of ash will finally drop on his shirt. "Congratulations on your distinguished career." He unwound himself to stand, shake hands. "Please, call me Artie. Finally we meet. Sit down, please. It's a pleasure doing business with a man who has made so much of himself in a relatively short amount of time in this country, and, if I may say so, on this earth. How old are you?" 31.
He squinted, evaluating.
Yeah, okay, you look it.
He studied the letter for only a few seconds before tossing it on his desk.
To make a long story short, you will have to answer this. If you don't, they will send you another. It's a form. They got millions of them. Please, tell me, what is it about this particular request that worries you?
I'm not really worried. There's nothing on that list that applies, honestly. Treason and sedition, violent overthrow. I'm all right until they add smoking in bed.
Artie laughed, bobbing his head from the shoulders.
I'm just wondering what's behind it before I answer. I make mistakes sometimes. I seem to be naive about certain things.
How so?
I grew up in Mexico in the revolution. Being a communist was just an ordinary household thing, about like fish on Fridays.
I grew up in a country like that also. New York in the 20s. You ever hear of Eugene V. Debs?
I think so.
So, grew up in Mexico, but you are a citizen of the United States. This much I know from working on your film contract. You were born here, moved to Mexico at the age of 12, as I recall. Returning when exactly?
September of 40. Before that, I was here 2 years to attend school. He was making notes.
Where and when?
Potomac Academy, Washington, D.C., 32 and 33.
District of Columbia in 32. The summer of the Bonus Army riots.
I know. I was in them. I was sick a few weeks from the tear gas. He looked up.
You were in the Bonus Army riots?
By accident. I was trying to make a delivery from the ANP.
Holy smokes! I will not put this in your dossier.
I don't think my dossier is going to be problematic.
Mr. Shepherd, should I call you Harry?
No, just Shepherd is fine, without the mister.
Shepherd, in 75 words or less, how would you describe your dossier?
Empty. That's the whole truth. I spent almost all my life until now putting food on other people's plates, eating their leftovers, if any.
So you could say my sentiments lodge in the proletarian quarter. The worker control of industry strikes me as a decent idea.
But I'm not a member of anything. Is that 75 words?
Or less. You are concise.
I don't even vote. My secretary needles me about that.
You believe in the class struggle, but you don't vote.
This country is a puzzle. In Mexico, even the conservatives grant the power of the syndicates, but here, during the strikes, the most liberal politicians called the mine workers' president a coal-black son of Satan. The conservatives probably just thought he was Satan Pear. It's a pretty watery broth, Republicans, Democrats.
This I will not deny.
In the war, they were all friends with Stalin, but now he's also joined the Satan family line.
That one I agree with.
This letter they've sent me, I only want to understand it, so I won't step in something. I tend to do that, step in things. He sat staring, the ash end of his cigarette growing long and white.
I see. This letter worries you because you're thinking you may get hit with somebody else's gas on your way to the ANP.
This letter confounds me. I know what communism is, but a few weeks ago my secretary was voted out of her woman's club because she asked a girl from Russia to give a lecture. Just a schoolgirl.
Shepherd, my friend, this month, in certain quarters, people are burning the Graphic Survey magazine because it contains a picture story on life in Russia. Photographs of farms, windmills, whatever they have on farms, Russian cows. This incites people to bonfires.
What do you think is frightening them?
Hearst News. If the paper says everyone this season will be wearing a Lily Dache hat that resembles an armadillo, they will purchase the hat. If Hearst tells them to be afraid of Russia, they will buy that too.
If the hat is too ridiculous, not everyone buys it. Artie finally ashed his cigarette, then paused to light a new one from the old, which he left burning in the ashtray, presumably for ambiance. He reorganized his S-shaped body into a thoughtful pose against the desk. "Do you want to know my theory?"
"Of course."
"I think it's the bomb."
"People are afraid of the bomb?"
"Yes, I believe that is the heart of the matter. When that bomb went off over Japan, when we saw that an entire city could be turned to fire and gas, it changed the psychology of this country. And when I say psychology, I mean that very literally. It's the radio, you see. The radio makes everyone feel the same thing at the same time. Instead of millions of various thoughts, one big psychological fixation. The radio commands our gut response. Are you following me?"
"Yes, I've seen that."
"That bomb scared the holy Moses out of us. We became horrified in our hearts that we had used it. Okay, it ended the war. It saved American life and so on and so forth. But everyone feels guilty deep inside. Little Japanese children turned into flaming gas. We know this. How could we not feel bad?"
"I'm sure we do, Mr. Gold."
"Okay, we used the bomb. We convince ourselves we are very special people to get to use this weapon. Ideal scenario, we would like to think it came to us from God, meant for our own use and no one else's."
He leaned in, eyes and cigarette blazing.
"You wrote a book about this topic, am I right?"
"You've read my books?"
"Of course I've read your books. You're an important client. I've read your books. You, of all people, understand this. Suddenly we are God's chosen. We have this bomb, and we better be pretty damn certain no one else is going to get this bomb. We must clean our house thoroughly. Can you imagine what would happen if England also had the bomb? France, Germany, Japan, and the Soviet Union all had this bomb. How could a person go to sleep at night?"
"Those countries hardly have standing armies now. They're sacked, all but the Soviet Union."
"Okay, the Soviet Union. You get it."
"I thought we had nothing to fear but fear itself."
"You see, this is what I'm saying. The radio. It creates for us a psychology. Here's what happened to fear itself. Winston Churchill said, 'Iron Curtain.' Did you see how they all went crazy over that?"
"Of course."
"Then Truman said, 'Every nation must decide.' You are standing on one side of that curtain, my friend, or else you are on the other. And John Edgar Hoover, my God, this man, John Edgar Hoover, says this curtain is what separates us from Satan and perhaps also the disease of leprosy. Did you happen to hear his testimony to Congress?"
"I read some of it."
"The mad march of red fascism in America, teaching our youth a way of life that will destroy the sanctity of the home and respect for authority. Communism is not a political party, but an evil and malignant way of life. These are his words. A disease condition. A quarantine is necessary to keep it from infecting the nation."
"I read that, but newspapers exaggerate. I couldn't quite believe he said all that."
"You have a point. Maybe he did not. And yet, in this case, it happens that he did. I acquired a transcript of this testimony because it pertains to certain of my clients."
"Why did he say it? I mean, what were his rational motives?"
"Rational motives are not the scope of this discussion. He is an excitable man. He heads a powerful agency. The newspapers love this kind of thing, as you say. It's a moment of history, my friend. You wonder why you've received this letter? I am attempting to draw you a picture."
"Is that really his signature?"
"No, they have a machine. I read Frank Sinatra has one also, for autographs. Maybe you need one. Okay, Do you know anything at all about this Dyes Committee?
I've heard of it. Years ago, they contacted my boss to come and testify. This was in Mexico. The State Department arranged visas for us, but it never happened.
Your Mexican boss had something to say about un-American activities?
Oh, he wasn't Mexican. He was in exile there, under threat of death from Stalin. So he had a lot to say about the man. This was before the war, when the U.S. was getting very friendly with Stalin. Trotsky felt the U.S. was being hoodwinked. They needed to know he was treacherous.
Trotsky.
Lev Trotsky. He was my boss. The cigarette ash fell to the floor. For a moment, the lawyer himself seemed poised to follow it. He straightened, shook his head slowly, and reached for the letter on the desk.
I am going to give you a piece of advice. Don't mention that you once were employed by the leader of the Bolshevik Revolution.
I was a cook, Mr. Gold, and this was Trotsky. He hated Stalin more than J. Edgar Hoover does. He spent his whole life trying to overthrow the Soviet Politburo. The American Communist Party vilified him.
Let me just say, these subtleties are lost on your secretary's woman's club, and they are lost on the Dyes Committee. Most of them don't know what communism is, could not pick it out of a lineup. They only know what anti-communism is. The two are practically unrelated.
You're telling me anti-communism is unrelated to communism? That doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense to you. You're a man of words, so you think we're speaking here of tuna fish and disliking tuna fish. But we are not. We're talking tuna fish and the Spanish influenza.
He reached into the papers on his desk and drew out a pair of spectacles.
All former places of residence and former employers, he read. Schools and colleges attended. Organizations in which you have been a member.
What should I write?
Tell them exactly what they already know. Mexico, they probably know very little. Military service record, they know. What was your tour?
Civilian service. That's how this came up. I helped move federal property for the Department of State during the war.
Civilian service. So you were 4F?
Something like that. He waited. The intensity of the man's gaze is extraordinary. Blue slip, I said.
Okay. Disqualified from service on account of sexual indifference to the female of the species. This one I could never figure.
They offered to put me in a psychiatric hospital to get me sorted out. But then suddenly my particular talents were needed elsewhere, moving art treasures out of Washington. Both coasts were under attack, so it looked very urgent.
This was when, 42?
The end of summer, right after the Japanese deployed their floatplane bomber from that sub they sent up the Columbia River. It looked like a good time for the country to get our goods undercover.
You're putting me on. If it weren't for Tojo attacking Fort Stevens?
That's right. I might be up at Highlands Hospital with Zelda Fitzgerald. Instead, I'm living down the street from there in a house I bought with Uncle Sam's paycheck.
Shazam, said Artie. All's fair in love and war.
Believe me, I know this better than most.
Well, for better or worse, all this they already know about you. What else? What employment history do they have in your file at the State Department?
I'm not sure. I think my name must have come to them through a gallery in New York where I delivered paintings from Mexico, or the school where I taught Spanish.
Okay, mention those. And anything you recall listing in your employment records at those establishments. Church membership, this kind of thing, to pad out the resume. Though you are not a joiner, you've said. So give them primary schools in Mexico, the one in D.C., the name of the painter who sent you to New York.
Will they really go and talk to instructors at the Potomac Academy?
So what? They'll find out you were a schoolboy.
I don't want to worry you excessively, but schoolboy shenanigans are not now your biggest concern.
September 3rd. Today, Bullseye departed, and all this he took with him. Schoolboy shenanigans, promises broken, dormitories and secret assignations. An invisible boy made manifest, seen for once by another's eyes, if only for a short while. A city of memories has gone up in fire and gas, and there can be no remorse. Mrs. Brown wouldn't tolerate having the notebook burned in the fireplace, but in the end she did the job herself, outside in the barrel where she burns scrap papers. Potomac Academy 1933 has left the world. She was opposed at first. You need your notebooks, she kept insisting. Without the notes, she fears I'll make a mess of things, like Tristram Shandy. She still refuses to believe the memoir will not be written. I met her gaze and leveled. Look, Mrs. Brown, you're a practical person. And you know me, so don't ask for impossible things. I'm working on a different book now.
So you say it.
It was a mistaken idea, the memoir, dragging my own entrails out for the public. And not my idea to start with, you'll recall. I told you I'd given it up when the little leather-bound diary turned up missing. Really, I should get rid of all of them, just so you'll quit nagging me about it. But I'm starting with this one. She had come a half hour early, today of all days, and caught me red-handed, the broad, canvas-bound notebook in my hand. I'd been wondering how to set that cotton duck to flame. The army tends to manufacture indestructible things. Stamped plainly across the front, Potomac Academy. She could probably see right through to the naked figures inside, as if catching me with an eight-pager. I may have blushed. If you won't let me burn it now, I told her, I'll just do it after you leave this evening.
Do as you please, then, this evening.
Without another word, she went to the dining room, slapped out the work on her table, and said little the whole day. But at 5 o'clock, crept upstairs to my study door.
Mr. Shepherd, be ye free for a word?
All right.
It's something to grieve you, is it, in that notebook you now want burned?
She has borne so much from her inconstant leader. The panics of last month, for example. A better August than some, but still she takes the brunt. It's nothing special, Mrs. Brown. I'm just ready to be done with school days.
Anybody would be queasy, with federal men nosing in your business.
She acknowledged the deed would already be done if she had not by chance caught the earlier bus this morning.
Mr. Shepherd, I've got no business depriving you of your own intents and purposes. Give it over, and we'll be done.
She took it out to the backyard. I watched from the upstairs window, wondering if she would have a glance inside. It's possible I was testing her, but she did not look. It was her choice to burn it in the barrel with the day's used envelopes and botched letters, rather than in the living room.
Here now, it's still the dog days, she said. What might the neighbors think, seeing smoke from your hearth on such a warm day of September?
She is out there now. The week's rubbish went into the tar barrel, the canvas-bound book flaring vividly in the center, its blackened leaves impossibly thin and intact, curling open before disintegrating. She stepped back from the heat of the barrel, but will remain at her post until everything is vapor. Viewed from above, she is framed by fences on both sides of the strange tableau. Mrs. Brown destroys the evidence. Her hat, a small blue plate, dampening in dark speckles as a light summer rain begins to fall. Now the job is done. September 8th. Today the appeasement program begins. After a weekend spent drawing together a mess of notes into genuine prose, I have produced evidence of a new book. Not just some vague excuse for avoiding the memoir, but two draft chapters of the novel set in Yucatan, handed over to Mrs. Brown. The setting is giving me trouble, though, as I've never visited the Yucatan. I need to see Chichen Itza, the stones of those temples. Mrs. Brown's eyebrows sailed just to hear the name spoken aloud. You could see the childhood longing still in her. The girl hiding in some chicken coop from Sister Parthenia, dreamily turning pages of the Geographic. I asked her to call the Asheville-Hendersonville Airport and find out how Pennsylvania Central Airlines might connect with Merida. Mexico City will probably be the best bet. No, not passage for one, for two. September 22nd. Harrison W. Shepherd, 30 Montfort Avenue, Asheville, North Carolina. Dear Mr. Shepherd, allow me to acquaint you with our services. Aware Incorporated is a private loyalty firm whose programs are independent of any government agency. Our corporation publishes the well-known directory, Strike Back, used to assist hiring practices in many entertainment and service-related industries. Employers from coast to coast have learned they can rely upon our research. We have information we believe to be important to your current federal investigation. We have evidence suggesting your books are being read by communists in China, and that you have opposed the use of the atom bomb. We have a news story linking you to Charles Chaplin, who is almost certainly a communist. We do not suggest that you are in fact a communist. In many cases, our clients find they have been painted as such via the weasel-worded gestures of someone who is in fact a communist. Every day, innocents in our country become pawns in the hands of sinister manipulations for the communist cause. The extent of their network is sadly underestimated by most. Attorney General Clark has released to us a list of 90 organizations the Justice Department believes to be communist fronts. Almost anyone could have unwittingly crossed paths with a person working under the guise of one of these organizations. For a fee of $500, we offer you the invaluable opportunity to clear your name of several charges, including those listed above. We urge you to contact us without delay to discuss this opportunity to secure our services. Sincerely yours, Lauren Mattis, Director, Aware Incorporated. September 23rd. No soap, says Artie Gold. You tell them that. Your attorney says no soap. Jump in a lake. Bye-bye, birdie. This letter you do not even have to answer. Artie had agreed to an emergency meeting on the condition we invite his 12-year-old friend Grant. Ha ha, as he would say. Grant is a blended Scotch whiskey. We met downtown on Patton Street, but en route to the bar he had to tramp through some errands. Coleman's Man Store to pick up a shirt. Margaret says if I show up one more time looking like a hobo, she will put me in a home. It's the husband's parents. They're snobs. Next, Reiser's Shoe Hospital, to fetch some resuscitated wingtips that should have gone to Reiser's crematorium, if there is one. Then Finkelstein's Pawn. Is this how you generally impress new clients? Artie had handed his ticket through the iron grill, and we were waiting for the retrieval. Ha! Don't worry, I am not living on Skid Row just yet, he said, although I wish the same could be said of all my clients. That ticket was given me in lieu of payment, a very nice camel overcoat, I'm told, to be had for only $10. Artie lowered his voice. I'm gonna give it back to the poor guy when cold weather hits. The bar was Leo's, a little joint in the odd Flatiron building that's wedged into the acute corner of Battery and Wall. This okay with you? Is it adequate to the purposes of impressing a new client? It's fine. I'm sorry, that was a joke. Okay, not very fancy, Leo's, but a club I am allowed to join.
Carefully, he folded and stacked his wardrobe on the stool beside him. Camel coat, shirt, shoes. The girl at the bar had reached for the bottle of Grant's when he came in the door, and came over with two little glasses hooked on her fingertips like thimbles. Artie seemed distracted, watching her fill the glasses, finishing his cigarette.
That club out at Bent Creek, you know it? I recently had a very high-profile client who moved here from Hollywood. Prospective client, I should say. I'm not naming names. He wanted to take me to his golf club for dinner, Bent Creek, to celebrate, get acquainted. Mr. Heston, I say to him, have you seen their promotional materials? We cater to the better class of Gentile clientele. We reserve the right to decline service to anyone we deem to be incompatible. Incompatible!
Charlton Heston is your client?
As it happens, he is not.
The waitress retreated to the other end of the bar, wiping out glasses with a red chamois cloth, but kept glancing at us. Dark lashes, cheekbones, a red ribbon around her black hair tied on top. A tall, long-waisted girl, but still there was something of Frida about her, the way she carried those glasses on her fingers. Probably a violation of some hygiene rule, but she gets away with it. Men want their lips on her fingertips.
Hey, how about that Jackie Robinson? Artie asked out of nowhere.
His mind moves like a train, and he pitches things out its window at an astonishing clip.
Are you a baseball fan, Shepherd?
I should apologize now for all the things I don't know about. You might find me as thick-skulled as Mr. Heston. Baseball is a yen one learns from a father, I gather. He tilted his head, nodded. Though quite a talker, Artie was also a listener. I wasn't raised in this country. Wasn't raised really at all. Artie exhaled a short laugh, not unsympathetic, and tossed back the shot of Grant's.
If a person is not raised, then what? He grows from a seed?
The whiskey was both stringent and soothing, like cigar smoke. 12 years waiting for a moment, this gullet. No, I told him. In the scullery kitchens and probably the salt mines of this world, many a child is not so much raised as hammered into shape, Artie. To be of use, surviving by the grace of utility alone.
This I know to be true. You are correct. Very well said. In this case, the absence of a father notwithstanding, have you heard of Jackie Robinson?
I do read the news. The Negro player they've led in the White Leagues.
I saw the man play at McCormick Field this summer. I was there.
How was that?
Sensational. His second or third game with the Dodgers, and they play him down here in Dixie. The colored section was packed like the last bus out of Arnhem, and the rest of the stands, empty. Like someone had yelled they were passing out free polio germs to the white people that day. I had a good seat, let me tell you.
I'll bet. He unfolded the letter and flattened it on the counter. The earlier one from J. Edgar Hoover he'd barely glanced at, but this one he studied with inordinate care. Nevertheless, his verdict, no soap. My secretary wanted to burn it with the trash.
Good girl! You should give her a raise.
Well, I'm taking her to Mexico.
Really?
A wise guy smirk. As my assistant, Artie, she's 47, for one thing, and for another, not my type.
Ah, yes, I recall.
You're only about the third or fourth person to know that about me, by the way. The Selective Service, God, and you. A few others, but certainly my mother never worked it out.
Please, discretion is my business. And I mean that sincerely.
Mrs. Brown is my right hand. This is a research trip, and I'll need to stay a couple of months, She called you about helping with the passport.
Right, I recall. Well, her opinion of this letter from quote-unquote Aware Incorporated was absolutely correct.
It's not a form, I pointed out. These things are very specific. Charles Chaplin. My book's being read by communists in China. I have to say, I'm flabbergasted.
That is their intention, to flabbergast. Is this a verb? Can I say that?
I suppose.
Their mode is the surprise attack. They flabbergast. You hand over 500 clams.
And then the game ends?
Not exactly. These publications he mentions are real. They accumulate names of alleged Reds and publish them in directories.
Who reads them?
Executives, radio producers, Hollywood studios, even grocery chains. It's handy, no muss, no fuss. They can assure their advertisers they are taking every available precaution against hiring a Red.
But before he puts me on the list, he's offering the chance to clear my name for a fee. Artie spread his hands wide.
God bless America.
That's straight blackmail. The employers must know the lists are meaningless.
So you would think, but this guy Mattis has acquired for himself a certain cachet. He used to be a member of the Communist Party. 20 years ago, when everybody, including your Aunt Frances, was a member of the Communist Party. Now he comes to the FBI, offers to come clean. Before you know it, they've got him in front of the HUAC, the whole works. So far, he's remembered hundreds of former associates who now work in government and the media. And for an additional fee, he will remember more. Amazing, his memory. The New York Times is a major employer of communists, he says. Time and Life also. This guy is a star.
And runs his own business on the side.
An entrepreneur.
Nobody could take this seriously, Artie. The girl was still watching us. Down at the opposite end, leaning backward against the bar, fiddling with the cameo on a ribbon around her neck. Artie sighed.
I have a client, a former president of a prestigious Southern college, served on the War Labor Board, currently president of the Southern Human Welfare Conference, a very celebrated guy. Consulting fees and public speaking provide most of his income. Suddenly, he has no income. He has protesters. This anti-segregation outfit over which he presides has turned up on the Attorney General's list, one of these 90 so-called Communist Front organizations.
On whose authority? Lauren Mattis?
The HUAC, in its infinite wisdom, has devised what they call an acid test for revealing an organization's true colors. You want to hear their criteria? Any one of the following is sufficient. Number one, it shows unswerving loyalty to the Soviet Union. Or, two, it has refused to condemn the Soviet Union. Or, three, it has gained accolades from the communist press. Or, four, it has displayed an anti-American bias despite professions of love for America.
So, if you love America but you hate the segregation laws?
Yes, that could arguably be an anti-American bias. Let me ask a rhetorical question. Has the American Poodle Society explicitly condemned the Soviet Union?
He signaled to the waitress, and she came immediately, as if pulled on a string. Refilled our glasses, her eyes carefully down. Then the quick smile, a flash of strong teeth with a tiny center gap. Away she went after that, unspooling the tether.
Well, let me ask you something, Artie said. A personal question, if I may. When you look at a beautiful girl, do you see beauty?
A fair question. When you look at a great painting, do you see beauty? You see color and form, right? Loveliness, allure, magnificence,
maybe even arousal. So tell me, Artie, do you want to have sex with the painting?
I'm sorry, my interest is not prurient. I'm just a curious man. Curiosity killed the cat, my wife used to tell me very often.
Anyway, this letter, you're advising me to ignore it?
I am advising you, he said slowly, that you are being approached by a snake. You could attempt to reason with the snake, or you could offer it a cash contribution. Most likely, the snake is still going to bite.
Grant's 12-year-old whiskey is a potent anesthetic. Luckily enough, Artie, it doesn't matter, because I'm not looking for a job right now. I have the only job I ever wanted.
Luckily enough, you are a writer, employed by the American Imagination. Your publisher does not have to answer to any sponsors, only to your readers.
Employed by the American Imagination. I like that very much.
Are they really reading you in China?
Goodness, no, not even in France. Some reviewer said, "Don't be surprised if this book shows up in China," something like that. They also said I was Chaplin-esque.
Well, many artists are not so lucky as yourself, Mr. Chaplin among them. Film stars, directors, television scriptwriters, they all have to be produced. They require sponsors. It's becoming a lucrative industry for the likes of Aware Incorporated.
Suddenly the girl was back, unsummoned. You're the writer, aren't you? I'm crazy about your books.
What writer?
Harrison Shepherd?
That's so strange. You're the second person to ask me that.
Oh, sorry, my mistake. She floated away, an unmoored skiff, and disappeared through a door at the back.
Artie reorganized his sigmoidal curve against the bar, the better to stare at his dimwit companion. What's wrong with you? She's a sugar pie.
I know it. I'm grateful. To all these girls, I really am.
So you could sign a damn cocktail napkin. It would have made her day.
That's what I can't see, Artie. What thrilled her was a book. She wants a hero, not some tin-whistle double gaiter on a bar stool.
So, in a pinch, you stand in.
Do you know how that feels to me, to pass myself off as important? Exactly like passing counterfeit money. Look at her. She's magnificent. My name, some ink on a napkin. How could that be worth the gold brick standard of her day?
Artie swiveled back to face the bar, fished a pack of old golds out of his pocket.
So, Mattis the Snake has contacted me because a motion picture option got his attention, that's what you think?
You know what they say. God wants to punish you, he answers your prayers.
Artie, I didn't pray for a motion picture. It makes me uneasy. I don't like attention.
You have a funny way of choosing your profession in that case.
People think that. If a person is famous, he must have wanted to be in the public eye. But to me, writing books is a way to earn a living in my pajamas. Artie nodded thoughtfully.
I take your point. People think lawyers are a cutthroat gang, and me? I couldn't cut the throat of a fish. Magra says I should take up fishing, and I think, an old softy like me? What would I do if I caught one? Apologize?
October 3rd. 2 airplane tickets purchased, air coach to Mexico and back, at a cost of $191 each. A breathtaking sum, but all in the line of duty. Arthur Gold says it can be worked out for some reduction in the tax later on. He is helping Mrs. Brown with the passport applications. Apartment queries sent to Merida, and fair warning to Frida, expect a visit, though Diego is sure to be out of the country. Romulus will feed the cats and mind the house. 8 weeks. I will have to remember to bring back a smashing present.
Mrs. Brown stands at the ready, her suitcase already packed, though the trip is 6 weeks away. No price is too high for this joy. Her thrill for adventure is a thing I dearly wish I could learn by example. She makes me wish for the boy who once could swim miles underwater looking for treasure. Today I teased her, asking whether I needed to look out for any fellow who might be angry with me for taking her off this way. She blinked, taken aback. "Well, it's not out of the question," I said. "I'm aware you're an attractive woman, and I've noticed you're sprucing up of late." She honestly blushed. "No nonsense, Mrs. Brown. She said not to worry myself. If any man she cared for took an interest, I would be first to know it." The New York Times, October 23, 1947. 79 in Hollywood found subversive, inquiry head says. "Evidence of communist spying will be offered next week," Thomas declares. By Samuel A. Tower, special to the New York Times. Washington, October 22nd. Actors, writers, and others in Hollywood were named today as members of the Communist Party or as communist sympathizers. The accusations were by Robert Taylor, screen actor, and by other movie figures as the inquiry of the House Committee on Un-American Activities into the extent of communist penetration into the film industry went into its third day. At the same time, the movie industry, reacting to a persistent committee criticism that no anti-communist pictures were being made, charged through its counsel, Paul V. McNutt, that suggestions concerning films to be made represented one method of censorship and did violence to the principle of free speech. The committee chairman, Representative J. Parnell Thomas, asserted that the committee would produce at coming sessions evidence that at least 79 persons in Hollywood had been engaged in subversive activity. After a noon executive session, the committee announced that it would present next week evidence of communist espionage activities with a surprise witness in developing further testimony that confidential data on an Army supersonic plane had fallen into communist hands through a Hollywood literary agent. Mr. Taylor, arriving to appear at the afternoon session, was greeted with an audible, "Ah!" by the spectators, mostly women, who filled the hearing chamber. Outside the chamber there was a mob scene as those unable to get in swirled and pushed against Capitol Police. In his testimony, he declared at one point, "I personally believe the Communist Party should be outlawed. If I had my way, they'd all be sent back to Russia." When this drew loud applause from the audience, Chairman Thomas reprimanded the spectators and requested no further demonstrations. Mr. Taylor asserted that there had been more indications of communist activity in Hollywood in the past 4 or 5 years, but guarded and qualified his testimony when committee interrogators sought specific data on activities and individuals. He testified that, as a member of the Screen Actors Guild, he had come to believe that there were actors and actresses who, he said, if not communists, are working awfully hard to be so, and whose philosophy and tactics seemed closely akin to the Communist Party line. This group constituted what he called a disrupting influence. The handsome actor declared that the film Song of Russia was, in his view, communist propaganda and that he had objected strenuously to playing in it. He added, however, that the industry at that time was producing a number of movies designed to strengthen the feeling of the American people toward Russia. Mr. Taylor asserted that he had not knowingly worked with a communist and would not do so. After 25 minutes on the stand, the handsome star made his departure, accompanied by applause and shouts of "Hooray for Robert Taylor!" from a middle-aged woman wearing a red hat. Members of the committee asked MGM executive James K. McGinnis, who is in charge of scripts for the studio, "Has the industry the will to make anti-communist movies? Why haven't they been made?"
Why couldn't the studios produce such films and circulate them through schools, like the patriotic wartime pictures? Representative Emanuel Seller, Democrat, New York, attacked the inquiry as an act to make, he said, all true Americans blush with shame. He continued, if Chairman Thomas sought to strike terror into the minds of the movie magnates, he succeeded. They were white-livered. One vital aspect of these antics must be kept in mind. Today it is the motion pictures. Tomorrow it may be the newspapers or the radio. The threat to civil liberties is a real one. October 31st. I have learned from experience, make the cookies early. The children will come to the door dressed as hobgoblins. When the doorbell rang just after 4 o'clock, Mrs. Brown carried the plate to the door. But it was a man, clearly audible. I was in the kitchen mopping up after the afternoon's baking. Flour covered everything like an early frost. No, he can't, she said in a strained voice. Mr. Shepherd is indisposed. Her instincts for protecting her boss are unflappable.
Are you the lady of the house?
I'm the stenographer. The badge startled her, and she can't remember the name. FBI, that much she remembers. He'd come to ask Mr. Shepherd a few questions, but as he was unavailable, Mrs. Brown was duty-bound to answer them herself, insofar as she was able. After it was all over and he left, she came in the dining room and put her head down on the table. I made a pot of coffee. Then, together, we remembered and wrote it down, to show Artie later.
How long has he lived in this house?
She guessed about 5 years.
No, the man said. Mr. Shepherd purchased this house October of 1943.
Then my stars, why ask?
Has he got a mortgage?
If a person has a house, he has got a mortgage. Evidently, you have the details.
Where did he live before?
He let a room from Marion Biddle at her boarding house on the Black Mountain Highway, what they call the Tunnel Road.
And before he came to Asheville?
I'm sure I don't know. I don't think I can answer any more questions.
Well, you'll have to try. Executive Order 9835.
What's that?
It means you have to try. If the FBI is asking, you answer. Where did he get that car? That's a pretty pricey car, or was in its day.
I believe the car belonged to his deceased father.
I noticed an empty Remy bottle in the trash. Is Mr. Shepherd a drinker?
I'm sure. I don't know. I think we're finished. Mr. Shepherd's lawyer might be the one to take this farther if needs be.
Look, lady, don't get sore. An investigation doesn't necessarily mean he's under suspicion. We're conducting a field investigation.
Of what?
Just the usual.
You can't tell me what it is you think Mr. Shepherd has done?
No, ma'am, we cannot.
But if he were here, you could tell him.
No, ma'am, we cannot tell the accused this kind of thing, for security considerations. Do you happen to know his income?
For goodness sake, he's a writer. He couldn't say himself what it's going to be month to month. Do you know what books people will buy next year?
Does he attend any meetings?
No.
Well, the neighbors said he does. They see him take the Haywood bus every Thursday. But on other days, only to the market or the newsstand.
Mr. Shepherd goes to the library on Thursdays.
Why so regular?
He finds it comforting to keep regular habits.
Ma'am, do you know what magazines he reads?
He buys about everything on the Haywood newsstand. You could go down there and make a list if you like.
Do you happen to know if he's ever studied up on Karl Marx?
Go and see if they sell Karl Marx on the Haywood newsstand.
Do you know where Mr. Shepherd stands on abstract art?
Well, if he wanted a good look, I expect he'd stand in front of it.
Very funny. Can you tell me the name of his cat?
Are his cats also under suspicion?
The neighbors said they hear him using an obscene word to call the cat.
I've never heard Mr. Shepherd use obscene language against any person, certainly not his cats.
Well, they say that he does. They say he uses a very vulgar word to call the cat. They're concerned for the youngsters. They say the boy comes over here.
My stars, what do they think he calls his cat?
I apologize, ma'am. It's a very vulgar word. They said jism.
The cat's name is Chisme. It means gossip. Mérida, Yucatan Peninsula, November 1947. Notes for a novel about the end of empire. When Cortez's men first arrived here, they asked in Spanish, "What is the name of this place?" From the native Mayans, they received the same answer every time, Yucatan. In their language, that word means, "I do not understand you." The apartment is decently spacious, the two bedrooms and a good-sized table for working in the main room, with the window overlooking the street. The kitchen and bath are a jumble, but there's no need for cooking. It's too easy to walk downstairs to the restaurant in the courtyard, morning or night. The previous residents must have shared this languor, because a long white sprout of a bean was growing from the drain of the sink when we arrived. I offered to put it in a pot for the balcony and call it our garden. Mrs. Brown did not smile at the joke. She submits to not one iota of domesticity here, except to make the coffee as she did at home. The inside of her room I have not seen. We simply chose doors at the beginning, and her lair remains a mystery. She emerges each morning in her gloves and Lily Dachet hat, as reliably as the little Mayan women in the market will be wearing their white embroidered blouses and lace-bottomed skirts. The gloves and Lily Dachet are Mrs. Brown's native costume. A typewriter is installed on the writing table, delivered yesterday, a sure sign of progress. A car and driver for touring the ancient sites may soon surface as well. Mrs. Brown has gamely got her sea legs on, already going to the shops on her own to get small necessities. Each day she manages more of the arrangements, soldiering through the obstacles of a language she cannot speak. My advice, which she did not heed, in answer to any question, say, "Yucatan, I do not understand." A reasonable title for the novel, The Name of This Place. But for now, the name of this place is mud, or so Mrs. Brown must think when forced to take her life in her white-gloved hands. She grips the sidearm of the rumble seat with one, the other squashing her hat to her head as we pummel down the peninsula over shocking roads, navigated by our fearless driver, Jesus. After all the time we spent searching for this combination, vehicle and driver both together in one place, I dare not ask whether he is old enough for the job. He is just a boy, despite the authority of his Mayan nose and magnificent profile. It's a shock to realize that, not his youth really, but my age, that he must regard me as a man, perhaps his mother's age, more or less, not worth any real study. A series of directions to follow, and a wage at the end of the journey. And yet he's seen something of life already, clearly. His shirt is weathered as thin as a newspaper, and the lower part of one ear is missing. It took a while to notice that. It's his left, away from the passenger's side. He calmly asserted, when asked, that it was bitten off by a jaguar. So he has the imagination, if not the experience, for labor in the service of a novelist. He can lecture on any subject without hesitation. Today, en route to Chichen Itza, it was the military history of his people, the Maya,
"More courageous than 10 armies of federales," he shouted above the banging axles and backfiring engine of the ramshackle Ford. Or mostly Ford. One door and the front fenders are of a different parentage. Across the land of the mestizo we ride in a mixed caste automobile. "At this place, Valladolid," Jesus announced above the racket, "we view the scene of the last Mayan rebellion. 100 years ago, the Yucateca took our whole peninsula back from the Ladinos. We declared independence from Mexico, like your Texas of North America, and nearly made it the nation of the Maya again." "Except for Mérida," he confessed, "where the federales lodged throughout the rebellion." But fate was decided at Valladolid. A final victory over the Mexican army was at hand, but just as the Mayan warriors were poised to strike, an old shaman came with urgent news. The ancient calendar said it was time to return to their villages to plant corn. They put down their weapons and went home. "The gods speak to my people in their hearts," says the boy called Jesus, beating his breast with one fist as he drives, head tilted back in slow-eyed tranquility, even as the tires hit another crater in the road and his whole body levitates. The Mayans obeyed the ancient imperatives of survival. They walked away from power, letting the federal army take back the peninsula and return it to Mexican rule. Somewhere during the lecture, he lost his way on the dirt track through jungle, and we found ourselves also called back to his home village, conveniently at lunchtime, as it happened. We were near enough to Chichen Itza. The temples of one of its outlying towns towered above the treetops, a monument to ancient prosperity, throwing its shadow across thatched roofs and the naked children who gathered to see what might emerge from this calamitous machine. We could as well have arrived by flying saucer. The mother of Jesus, similarly slow-eyed, bade us sit on a log while she dipped beans from a cauldron that must bubble eternally on the fire outside her hut. Her name? Maria, naturally. Her lath house, like everyone in the village, had a tall, peaked roof of thatch, open at each gable end for ventilation. Inside the open doorway, a knot of motionless brown limbs, presumably sleeping children, weighted a hammock into a deep V shape, the inverse of the roof line. At the side of the house, a scrambled garden grew, but the front was bare dirt, furnished only with the logs on which we perched. Mrs. Brown steadied the tin plate on her knee with a gloved hand, tweed skirt pulled around her knees, eyebrows sailing high, calf leather brogues set carefully together in the dust. Flowering riotously around her were 100 or more orchids planted in rusted lard tins. White, pink, yellow, the paired petals hung like butterflies above roots and leaves. "My beauties," Maria called them, leaning forward to brush a speck of ash from her son's worn shirt, then gently boxing his good ear. "The only importance is beauty." The light here at the window is good, and the view is a satisfying distraction. The street stays busy at all hours. This apartment is only a short walk from the central plaza, the markets, and old stone cathedral. It must be the oldest part of Mérida, judging by its charm and conspicuous fortifications. In the afternoon, when the sun lights the stucco buildings across the street, it's possible to count a dozen different colors of paint, all fading together on the highest parts of the wall. Yellow, ochre, brick, blood, cobalt, turquoise, the national color of Mexico. And the scent of Mexico is a similar blend. Jasmine, dog piss, cilantro, lime. Mexico admits you through an arched stone orifice into the tree-filled courtyard of its heart, where a dog pisses against a wall, and a waiter hustles through a curtain of jasmine to bring a bowl of tortilla soup, steaming with cilantro and lime.
Cats stalk lizards among the clay pots around the fountain. Doves settle into the flowering vines and coo their prayers, thankful for the existence of lizards. The potted plants silently exhale, outgrowing their clay pots. Like Mexico's children, they stand pinched and patient in last year's two small shoes. The pebble thrown into the canyon bumps and tumbles downhill. Here, life is strong-scented, overpowering. Even the words. Just ordering breakfast requires some word like toronja, triplet of muscular syllables full of lust and tears, a squirt in the eye. Nothing like the effete grapefruit, which does not even mean what it says. Our young Lord Jesus today found the right track to Chichen Itza. What a marvel! The Temple of Warriors, the Ball Court, the tall pyramid called the Castle. Magnificent limestone buildings glare at one another in silence across the grassy plaza. Everything is dazzling white, a timeless architecture of pale limestone, elegant and remote. Whatever I came here looking for is hiding, holding its breath. No crime and punishment present themselves in blood-stained hallways. Unlike the grisly Azteca, with their gods sticking out their tongues, the Maya seem serenely untouchable. What they've left behind is in every measure as grand and elegant as the white marble temples of the Greeks. In the fringe of forest surrounding the plaza, we found more temples crumbling quietly into themselves, sleeping under green blankets of vine, like the ruin in the forest on Isla Pichol, beside the hole in the water at the end of the lacuna. That one had a smiling skeleton carved on a stone. Here, footpaths through the trees led away in all directions to different parts of a partially excavated city. The marketplace with its carved columns. The steam bath in a shady grove, its dark stone chamber like a womb, entered through a tiny triangular doorway. The vault inside was a high inverted V shape, punctuated at each end with a round hole for venting steam. Maybe the story begins here, lit by a dim, steamy ray of light streaming through that hole. The setting for a love scene, or a murder, better yet. Political intrigue. But the place feels bloodless. The enormous central pyramid stands high and heroic, dominating the plaza. It seems taller than the Pyramid of the Sun at Teotihuacan, though memory can play tricks in matters of heroism. We felt compelled to climb its immense stone stairs to the very top, just as it was with Frida all those years ago, dragging her miserable leg all the way. But Mrs. Brown managed the climb without sending a single soul to the devil. Today we drove south through villages of Mayan farmers, most beginning with X, pronounced Ish. Ishpuil, Ishmal, Jesus revealed the secret of the Mayan tongue. Shh. X does not mark the spot, it marks a hush. The Mayans still speak their language everywhere in the countryside, and it sounds like whispered secrets. Women stand together in doorways, muttering, shh, shh. Fathers and sons walk along the roadside carrying ancient-looking hoes, quietly making a plan. Shh. Another day driving, this time to the east. We stopped at a town and walked out an ancient stone roadbed to the mouth of a lacuna. A cenote, it's called here. A deep, round hole with limestone cliffs for its sides and blue water at the bottom. A kingfisher darted through foliage, calling, "Kill him! Kill him!" The view from above was dizzying, down the sheer rock face of the hole to the water far below. No handrail stood at the cliff's edge to prevent our falling in, or diving in, swimming down deep to see what is there, the devil or the sea. It is fresh water here, many kilometers from the ocean.
The Mayans built their towns and civilizations on these cenotes, because no sacred thing is more holy than a water source. The entire Yucatan Peninsula has not a single river or stream running on its surface, only these water caves running below, with round mouths opening here and there to the light above. Chichen means mouth of the world, and so it is. These gasping mouths are as old as human dread. The ancients fed them as best they knew how, throwing in jade and onyx, golden goblets, human remains, without a thought to what they might be doing to their drinking water. Jesus claimed that many valuable artifacts had been dredged from this cenote, but all had been carried off to Harvard and the Peabody Museum. He actually named those places, so it likely could be true. Colonial ransacking in the scientific age. On our walk back through the jungle, we looked but could find no trace of the ancient farms and villages that must have been here. Thousands of ordinary people were part of this metropolis, but their homes would have been perishable wattle and thatch, stuccoed with lime and mud. Every trace of their living has returned to the earth now, except for the limestone temples of art and worship, the things made of ambition, which rise higher than daily bread. Our automobile parked in the village had attracted a crowd. The tallest boy introduced himself, Maximiliano, and demanded pay for having guarded the vehicle during our absence. "From whom?" we asked. And Maximiliano pointed to the gang of small thugs he claimed would have damaged or even dismantled it. "They are very crafty," he said in English. His payment, a handful of coins, he instantly distributed among all the vandals, their alliance thus perfected. Even morality is a business of supply and demand. Some older boys had lurked back, distancing themselves from piracy, but came forward then with wood carvings to sell. Mrs. Brown took one in hand, turning it carefully. They were figures of ancient warriors in elaborate headdress, very much like my little obsidian fellow. It was striking how the wide, slant faces of the figures resembled the faces of the boys who made them. Mrs. Brown paid the sculptor his price, only a little more than the extortion had cost us. A good day for young men standing on the stone and bones of their ancestors to make their way. In the plaza near our apartment, people come every evening to stroll around in a circle. Lovers come drifting, connected by entwined fingers. Married couples come at a clip, the children like rafts towed on ropes behind the ship. No one is alone. Even the vendors sitting on stools around the periphery work steadily at connection, nodding at potential buyers, like a sewing machine prodding its needle into the cloth. "We used to do this in Isla Pichol," I told Mrs. Brown. "My mother always wanted to go walk the circle, as long as she had a new dress." Mrs. Brown, in the jaunty blue beret, dissected her fried fish, a late supper after our day on the road. But life in the plaza was just waking up. Two men wheeled a great wooden marimba to a spot near the dining tables and uncloaked it, preparing to play. She said, "You're home here. That's good to see. It serves you well." "I don't know that I'm home anywhere." "Well, you are a queasy one, I'll grant it," she said. She used her knife to push the fish's crisp head and tail together at one side of the plate. "I always knew you came from Mexico. At Miss Biddle's you told us that. But see, we thought you were just bashful. We never thought of a whole country where you could call down a waiter in his language, or say, 'Look, they're going to do the hat dance,' and they would do the hat dance. Now, that sounds silly." "No, I understand. You thought foreigner and not of a particular place." "I reckon that is it. All along, you have known about these folk here, and I've had no inkling. I read the geographics, but you can't think of the people in those stories as having life and breath. and knowing things you don't. But that sounds silly, too. No, I think most people are the same, until they've gone somewhere. I thank my lucky stars, Mr. Shepherd, and I thank you, I do, that I'm a person who went somewhere. She set her hands in her lap and drew herself fully into looking outward, as people do when settling down in a theater. Vendors had begun to work the dining crowd. You could buy anything if your supper went on long enough. Roses, bicycle tires, a shellacked armadillo. A mother and daughter in long skirts and shawls moved from table to table showing their embroidery. I waved them off with a gesture so small Mrs. Brown probably didn't see. She feels obliged to look at every single thing, lest the artisans be offended. "I have been wondering what your novel will be about," she said, "apart from the setting." "I wonder, too. I think I want to write about the end of things, how civilizations fall and what leads up to that, how we're connected to everything in the past." To my shock, she said, "Oh, I wouldn't." "Mrs. Brown, I declare, that's twice you've told me how to be a writer. You apologized the first time." "Well, I'm sorry again." "Why would you say that?" "I have no business. It just came out. Some of the things that happened back home have set me to the fret." "I do step in the pie sometimes. I know that. Go on." "Should I?" "Please." "I think the readers won't like it. We don't like to see ourselves joined hard to the past. We'd as soon take the scissors and cut every ribbon of that." "Then I am sunk. All I ever write about is history." "People in gold arm bracelets, though. Nothing that would happen to our own kind. That's how I reckon people take it so well." "So I shouldn't try something new? What happened to the writer standing up for himself, not leaving my words to be orphaned, my little bairns, as you called them?" "I still hold by that. But there's no shame in a clever disguise. To say what you believe and still keep out of trouble. Thus to now, it has done you well." "Oh, then you think it wouldn't go so well if I set my stories, let's say, in a concentration camp in Texas or Georgia, one of those places where we sent our citizen Japs and Germans during the war?" She looked stricken. "No, sir, we would not like to read that. Not even about the other Japanese sinking ships and bombing our coast. That's over, and we'd just as soon be shed of it." The marimba players struck up La Llorona, the most cheerful rendition of a song about death. I spied the man with the shellacked armadillo for sale. It was only a matter of time. He comes every night. "If that's so, Mrs. Brown, then why did the Americans make off with the historical artifacts of Mexico to put them, where did he say, in the Peabody Museum?" "It's the same as your books, Mr. Shepherd. It's somebody else's gold pieces and bad luck. If we fill up our museums with that, we won't have to look at the dead folk lying at the bottom of our own water wells." "And who is we?" She pondered this, eyebrows lowered. "Just Americans," she said. "That's the only kind of person I know how to be. Not like you." "You'd do that? Take scissors and cut off your past?" "I did already. My family would tell you I went to the town and got above my raisings. It's what Parthenia calls modern." "And what would you call it?" "American, like I said. The magazines tell us we're special, not like the ones that birthed us. Brand new. They paint a picture of some old country rube with a shawl on her head and make you fear you'll be like that, unless you buy cake mix and a home freezer." "But that sounds lonely, walking around without any ancestors." "I don't say it's good. It's just how we be. I hate to say it, but that rube in the shawl is my sister, and I don't want to be her. I can't help it." A man walked among the tables working a marionette, a smiling skeleton of articulated papier-mâché bones. To the delight of a family dining nearby, he made the skeleton sneak along slowly, lifting its bony feet high, then suddenly leap on their table. The children squealed as it stamped on their plates for the father's coins. "And history," I said to Mrs. Brown, "is nothing but a cemetery?" The puppeteer was behind her. She'd missed the show. "That is exactly right. For us to visit when we have a mind, or just not go at all. Let the weeds grow up. Here in Mexico, there's a holiday just for being with your dead. You go where your family is buried and have a great party, right on the grave." "You have to? Plumb on top of the graves?" Wide-eyed, she looked like the girl she must have been before she was Mrs. Brown. "People love it as much as they love a wedding. Really, it is a kind of wedding to the people in your past. You take a vow they're all still with you. You cook a feast and bring enough food for the dead people, too." "Well, sir, that would not happen in Buncombe County. Probably the police would arrest you."
"You might be right."
She took her glass of limeade and sipped at the straw while holding eye contact. It was unsettling. The puppeteer had moved into her line of view, and her eyes left me to follow that skeleton. When she had drained her glass, she said, "You understand things like that. A wedding in the graveyard. You are from another country." "But I want to be brand new too, Mrs. Brown. The land of weightless people and fast automobiles suits me fine. I made myself a rider there."
"You could have stayed here and done the same."
"I don't think so. I've thought about it. I had ghosts to leave behind. Mexican writers struggle with their ghosts, I think, in general. Maybe it's easier to say what you want in America without those ancestral compromises weighing you down like stones.
Easier to look down upon others, too."
"Do you mean to say I do that?"
"Mr. Shepherd, you do not, but some do. They look around and say, 'This here is good, and that is evil,' and it's decided. We are America, so that over there must be something else altogether."
Mrs. Brown will never cease to amaze. I told her, "That's very insightful. You think that comes of cutting our anchor to the past?"
"I do.
Because if you had to go sit on a grave and think hard about it, you couldn't just say, 'This is America.' Some Indian would cross your mind, some fellow that shot his arrow on that very spot, or the man that shot the Indian, or whipped his slaves, or hung up some tart woman for a witch. You couldn't just say it's all fine and dandy."
"Maybe readers need some of that, then, connections to the past."
"Fairly warned is fair afeard," she said.
"I thought it was forearmed. Forewarned is forearmed."
She glanced at her forearms and never did reply. Today was the village of Oktun, a town the color of wheat, with a pyramid sitting at its center. It brought to mind the village with the giant stone head in the square and Mother's shaman. Every turn in the road here runs into memory. Isla Mujeres was almost unbearable from the ferry on. Mrs. Brown sees all, and it puts her on a fret, as she would say. I imagine her pressed against the fretboard of God's guitar, held against the slender silver bar until she wails her assigned note. She says she came here to do my worrying for me. She does much more, typing up drafted scenes, only to see me throw them away. Arranging things. She's befriended someone English-speaking at the Tourist Bureau, a journalist who helps her negotiate miracles. Mexico's bureaucracies do not daunt Mrs. Brown. She has worked for the United States Army. I told her I want to study village life now, up close. We've seen enough of pyramids. I need goats and cook fires.
to peer inside a hut and examine that V-shaped vault after seeing the same architecture in stone temples. Her inspired idea? To return to the village of Maria, mother of Jesus. The eternal cauldron of beans still bubbled. Maria was animated while serving us lunch, telling us about the lumbermen who passed through earlier this morning. They are clearing the forests all around, dragging out the felled giants on the same dirt track that brought us in. All she can do is stand in the road and halt each truck, insisting they let her inspect the fallen timber and pluck the living orchids from its top branches. That explains the flowers growing from tins in the yard, her rescued orphans. These orchids lived all their lives high up in the bright air, unseen by human eyes, until the firmament under their roots suddenly tumbled. It's a precarious place, up there with the howlers. Everyone wants the tallest tree to fall. But Maria of the orchids seemed to have no such fears, at home in the forest primeval. "The important thing is beauty," she said once more, reaching a small brown hand toward the treetops. "Even death grants us beauty." Another visit to Chichen Itza tomorrow, the last trip. Then we pack it all in. We will need to take the train for Mexico City on Thursday or Friday if we are to be there from Christmas until the New Year, as Frida insists. Candelaria is meeting us at the station. Candelaria at the wheel of an automobile seems as probable as Jesus running a guided tour. Or Mrs. Brown in hat and gloves sitting beside the flagrant Frida, drinking tea on a bench painted with lightning bolts. Likely all these things will come to pass. Chichen Itza looked completely different today, probably because of everything else we've seen since the first visit. Elegant and remote, I jotted in my notes that time, reluctant to reveal its human history. But today, a story came up in relief from every surface, urgent and visible. Every stone was carved with some image, the snarling jaguar, the feathered serpent, a long frieze of swimming goldfish. Emperors stood life-size on stone steles jutting up from the plaza like giant teeth. The Maya carved human figures only in profile, the almond eye, the flattened forehead sloping toward the exquisite arch of nose. They needn't have worried about that profile being forgotten. It's the spitting image of Jesus and 10,000 others, automobile vandals included. Better to carve something else in stone if you mean to be remembered. I was cruel to my best friend and got away with it. My favorite meal was squid in ink sauce. My mother never quite liked me as I was. Traces of paint clung to the surfaces, too. Red, green, violet. In their time, all these buildings were brightly painted. What a shock to realize that. And how foolish to have been tricked earlier by the serenity of white limestone. Like looking at a skeleton and saying, "How quiet this man was, and how thin." Today, Chichen Itza declared the truth of what it was. Garish. Loud and bright, full of piss and jasmine, and why not? It was Mexico. Or rather, Mexico is still what this once was. For the last time, we climbed the tall pyramid, El Castillo. "We don't have to go on, you know," I told Mrs. Brown, halfway up. The day was so bright and hot it almost tasted of gunpowder, and she had left her hat in the car, where Jesus was now napping. She paused on the stone step, shading her eyes with one flat hand, her hair blowing back like the mermaid on the prow of a ship. She had removed her gloves to use both hands for the climb. The steps were that monstrous. "Of course we do," she said, sighing deeply, as if to say, "Men do this." And that is a fact, men do. Unable to resist the same impulse that built the thing in the first place, senseless ambition. but the view from the top, we convinced ourselves, was worth the pain. We sat on a ledge looking down on the tourists in the plaza, pitying those little ants because they were not up here, and if they ever meant to be, they would have to pay the price. And there is the full sum of it, senseless ambition reduced to its rudiments. Civilizations are built on that and a waterhole. Imagine the place crawling with slaves and kings, I said. 10,000 slaves to every one king, I'd imagine. And barking dogs, and mothers, wondering if their children have fallen down the well. We stayed a good while reconstructing the scene. She was curious about how a writer decides where to begin the story. You start with in the beginning, I told her, but it should be as close to the end as possible. There's the trick. How can you know? You just decide. It could be right here. In the first light of dawn, the king in maroon robes and a golden breastplate stood atop his temple, glowering down at the chaos. He understood with dismay that his empire was collapsing. You have to get right into the action. Readers are impatient. If you dilly-dally, they'll go turn on the radio and listen to Duffy's Tavern instead, because it's all wrapped up in an hour. How could the king know his empire is about to collapse? Because everything's in a mess. Fiddlesticks, she said. Everything's always a mess, but people say, buck up, we just have to get through this one bad patch. True enough. But you and I know it was, because we've read about it. Chichen Itza was the center of a vast and powerful empire. Art and architecture that flourished for centuries, and then around 900 after Christ, it mysteriously vanished. People don't vanish, she said. Hitler took his life, but Germany is still there, just for example. People going to work and having their birthdays and what all. True enough. And the Mayans who now people this forest surely do not think of themselves as a failed culture. They build their huts of ancient design, make gardens, and sing children to sleep. Rulers and generals change without their notice. In the time since Cortez, the great Spanish Empire has collapsed into one small landmass of rock and vineyards, the little right paw of Europe. Its far-flung provinces have been lost, the million shackled subjugates set free. Spain outlawed slavery, built schools and hospitals, and its poets, come to think of it, are practically in a contest now to condemn the Spanish history of conquest. Did Cortez see all that roaring toward him like a steam locomotive? Did England or France? All this earnest forward motion, the marches to the mountain, the murals and outstretched hands. Which part of it do we ever call failure? A novel needs a good collapse, I maintained. Success and failure. People read books to escape the uncertainties of life. And they build pyramids to last forever, so we can have something to climb on top of and admire. You know best, she said, but there's no use admiring a thing just because it lasted. My brother once had a boil on his bottom a whole year, and it was nothing you'd want to see in the photo gravure. Violet Brown, the poet, she laughed. I'll remind you of that boil next time you try to stop me from burning old notebooks and letters. Oh, she didn't like that. She pulled her thin cotton gloves from under her belt where she'd tucked them. Put them on, smoothed ruffled feathers. Some things are worth remembering, and some are not. That's all I meant. And you can say which is which? No, I can't. But piling rocks on top of rocks might not be the ticket. Maybe we should admire people the most for living in this jungle without leaving one mark on it. But how would we know about them 1,000 years later? In 1,000 years, Mr. Shepherd, the cow can jump over the moon. That was the end of it, because a rising storm cloud began to turn the day a menacing color, driving us down from our eyrie. The heavens let loose as we reached the ground. Children who'd been hawking wood carvings and embroidery now disappeared into the forest for shelter, while the tourists hurried back to their autos. Behind us, the temples stood in the strange yellow light, with rain darkening their stone pates, dissolving their limestone one particle at a time, carrying off the day's measure of history. Part 5. Asheville, North Carolina, 1948 to 1950. Signed, V.B. Star Week, February 1, 1948. Southern Star shines on Shepherd Romance. Young men in the land of sky seem to prefer the taste of old wine. A decade ago, in Asheville, North Carolina, young writer Thomas Wolfe rocketed to fame, fleeing Southern scandal for Manhattan's forgiving bohemian scene and the arms of a lady 17 years his senior. The writer's family tried to squelch the match with comely theater designer Aline Bernstein. That's Mrs. Bernstein. And so did Mr. Bernstein, we're guessing. But Wolfe carried the torch to an early grave. Now Harrison Shepherd is out to prove history repeats. This Asheville writer rode his pen to the heights with Vassals of Majesty and last year's Pilgrims of Chaltepec, ringing up more sales than Wolfe saw in a lifetime. Thanks to secretive habits and a well-known scorn for press correspondence, Shepherd has nudged over Wolfe as the talk of his town. In a new move, plainly inspired by his tutor, Shepherd has now linked up with a lady exactly 17 years his senior. Married at least once, say our sources. Little else is known about the mysterious Violet Brown, but the trim brunette must have some powerful lure for snaring this diffident bachelor and his piles of cash. You could hear the hearts crack on both sides of the Mason-Dixon last month as the couple took a pre-honeymoon tour through Mexico, Shepherd's boyhood home, where his family still resides. Did Mamacita approve the January-May romance? Do wedding bells toll for Harrison Shepherd? Not just yet, says airport clerk Jack Curtis, who viewed the couple's passports on their recent return to the Asheville-Hendersonville airport. Mr. Tall, Dark, and Handsome kept a tight hand on his shrinking Violet, but as of January 26th, she is on the books as widowed. And the bachelor? Curtis reports, still single. February 6th. When she came in with both arms loaded and dumped the mail and papers in a heap on the dining room table, my first thoughts were purely selfish. Alas, this mess. The world comes in. I'd wanted her to take more days off after our return, craving time upstairs undisturbed. To be in my pajamas still at supper time, the shades still drawn, reeling out my tale of Lord Itza and his troubles. A story needs a good collapse. She began talking before she'd unbuttoned her coat, plainly out of sorts. She is not like that, filling up a silence with idle talk. The goings-on at Mrs. Biddle's while we were away. Then came the report that Mr. Judd had died on Christmas Day. So that was it, I thought. I gave condolences. Well, it was his time. Even Marian Biddle thought so, and she is not one for philosophy. She said the son came right away and took care of everything so she could go on with her Christmas. But this is what floored her. Before the old man was even buried, 9 people read the obituary and came asking to let the room. Some of them had families. Can you imagine wanting to bring a wife and children all to live in the one room? There's no rooms for let anywhere. It's all the war marriages, and now these babies nobody thought to expect. Mrs. Biddle says a man bought a potato field outside town and is putting up 200 houses out there. Just houses, she says. Not a single shop for them to get their goods.
I suppose they'll have to come all the way into town for that. And the houses all alike. Maybe each one is a little different shade of color, but the same house over and over, lined up in a row. Goodness, it sounds like Moscow. Who would live in a place like that?
Well, that's the thing. The plan is for 200 houses, but 700 families are already lined up to buy them.
Then she sat down at the table and began to sob. It has never happened before. The day the agent came to the door, she felt faint afterward and put her head on the table. But this was different. Her shoulders racked. She let out a thin, throbbing wail.
Now, it can't be as bad as that.
I sounded like an actor in a play. Two absurd people in this room, and I had not been introduced to either one. I was still thinking somehow her distress went back to the housing shortage. She'd seen the first of the stories several days ago, but didn't phone, hoping to spare me embarrassment for a while, or else not knowing what to say. All the stories linking us romantically, she has been carrying that alone. Remarks and stares at the library and the market. I know she is often recognized. I couldn't read much of it. It made me feel too helpless, lost in some landscape of murdered truth. Lev would have been scientific, tracking the trail of this particular prevarication, studying how the branches diverged and where the thing started, probably in Star Week or The Echo. Though the story also made the reputable papers, and of course the Trumpet. It always begins somewhere, one howler waking up the others. They pass it on, embellished, not through any creative drive, but only a pure, slothful failure to verify a fact. If the reporters made any calls, it would have been for soliciting a denial. Failing that, they run it as truth. Upping the ante just enough to put their own byline on it. The lady is demure, and then fatally demure, and then has a tragic past. I am evidently now locked in a battle with an old-fashioned Mexican family over my right to pursue the love match. Only when I made the coffee did I see my hands were shaking. I have had dreams of being shot, watching the blood pour out, and wondering whether it hurts. I set a cup near her elbow, but couldn't sit down opposite her, not like a husband facing a wife across a meal. We used to do that at Mrs. Biddle's, of course, when I was the cook and she the worldly secretary. A lot of water under the bridge. I stood. After a time, she sat up and looked at the coffee strangely, as if it had been delivered by fairies. It struck me like a draft of cold air then, about Mrs. Biddle and the housing shortage. Is she making you move out because of this?
She raised my monthly rate. She said she would have to if I meant to stay there, due to the publicity.
That's ridiculous. You're in a bind and she's taking advantage. Do you want me to call her?
How would that look, Mr. Shepherd? You protecting me?
I don't know. I'll pay it. She knows I couldn't find a single other room in town with things the way they are.
Is the shortage really as bad as that?
Of course, it is in the papers everywhere. It just didn't occur that everywhere was here.
Folks read the obituaries and the homicides now, Mr. Shepherd, to find a room let open. But the police and the undertaker families get those. The rest of us had just as well reckoned the next house to open up for us will be the Cedar Box.
Mrs. Brown, goodness, this isn't like you.
It weighed, these rooms I have, riches undeserved. For a single person who could easily live in little more than a cedar box, and frequently has.
Anyhow, she said, I've gone years without a hike at Ms. Biddle's. The new man is paying twice as much. I'm lucky to have what I have.
I'll raise your salary to compensate for it.
You needn't.
No, I will. If you can find another place suitable, tell me what it costs.
She went to the water closet and ran the water in there, probably washing her face. When she came out, she retrieved the letter opener from the drawer where she keeps it, like the woman in a play who draws the revolver from the bureau. Instead of shooting the villain, she sat down and began to sort envelopes into piles, not glancing up.
Look, I'll talk to the presses about this, or send out a statement denying the romance business. Whatever you want me to do to defend your name.
I'm nobody. I don't have any name. It's your own you have to think about.
Well, in that case, there's nothing to be done. This is just more of the usual. We could have expected it.
I should have thought before I asked you to go with me.
She began slitting envelopes open. Her hair was in a net, her wool sweater buttoned to the throat. She looked 10 years older than when I'd seen her last.
At least, I said, it can't get any worse now. We're walking away from the wreck. It's just what happens.
What happens? She asked, in a curiously snipped tone.
Del árbol caído todos hacen leña. From the fallen tree, everybody makes firewood.
At that, she looked up.
Mr. Shepherd, where did we fall?
February 14th. Dear Shep, what's tickin'? Be my Valentine? Oops, you're taken. I read all about it in the papers. Well, hats off to you, pal. I've thought of bagging an older pigeon for myself. She wouldn't ask for a lot in the boodle department, and it throws everyone else off the scent. But the hell you yell! One of the hearts you cracked north of the Mason-Dixon was mine. Did I have to read about it in the Echo?
When are you coming to New York?
The new job at the museum is steady, mostly sweetening up the top cats for cash. I've got an apartment in the Lower East 70s now. Very voot. Kerouac was spotted in the neighborhood, and Artie Shaw plays in a joint on the corner. But forget about Bebop. Keep your eye out now for a potent lad named Frankie Lane. Tell him Tomcat sent ya. Are you the only news in Asheville these days? How's about that old girl Zelda? Think she'd marry me? I hear she resides in one of the white coat joints there in your fair city. Did Scott come around on visiting days when he was still kicking? You need to cut me in on the juicy stuff. Or are you riding so high on the rocket to fame you can't throw your old pal a saludo? From now on, I'll just have to read Star Week to find out what's oop papa da with Harrison Shepherd. Dig you later, Tom Cuddy. March 11th, 1948. Dear Tom, it's strange you asked about Zelda Fitzgerald. She died in a fire 2 nights ago. It started in the hospital kitchen and went up the dumbwaiter shaft into her room. A freak tragedy. There's no guessing what the national presses will say, but I'm cutting you in on the scoop, as you asked. I heard about the dumbwaiter from the fire marshal himself this morning at the tobacco stand where I get the morning papers. Highland Hospital is just at the top of my street. Zelda and I have been neighbors for years, but I haven't given her much thought. Now I feel like a bum. It could have been any of us in that hospital, Tom. The rest of my news is not such a bring down. I am coming along very well on the new book and have signed a motion picture package on the last one. Most definitely, I am not married or involved in any secret romance. Those stories are completely invented. The Violet Brown in question is my stenographer. She wears cotton gloves indoors, and unless some terrible accident has deceived us, never has shared a coffee cup that touched my lips. She accompanied me on the research trip to Yucatan, so the gossip marketers must have learned about it and fallen in love with their fantasies. Believe me, the lady is chaste. This latest run of stories has been very troubling, harder for her than for me. I'm constantly stupefied that anyone believes the nonsense that runs in the papers, and yet they do.
time and again. "Tommy, you ought to know I am not one for marriage, any more than I was one for the Army back when you and I were ducking bullets for the National Museum. So put your poor, cracked heart back together, soldier. I didn't snub you from any wedding list. I have no plans for New York soon, but you should visit here. Asheville has changed since the war. We are said to be a tourist destination first rate. Out on the tunnel road, they have a brand new contraption that will wash and wax an auto with the driver still in it. We have instant coffee here, too, and lady drivers. Are we voot? You shall have to come and see for yourself. Until then, I am, as you may have heard, still single. Shep.
March 22nd. Dear Shep, my friends are all green that I am hep to Shep, especially when I told them about your movie package. Holy Joe, congrats on that. Could you find a tiny role for me? I'll be the lad in the loincloth sitting on a rock, smoking a herd of camels during the battle scene, trying to sneak a gander at Robert Taylor. Lord and Butler, that fellow is cuter than Snappers. I'm pointing the finger at anything pink now I see in the papers. Please advise. A friend here seems to be in that kind of hash. He works in radio, but has the looks for television. Puerto Rican, a Latin dreamboat type. With brains, even. This boy reads, and very impressed I know you, by the way. Up until last year, he was a steaming Romeo. Now he can't get hired for anything. He was mixed up with the communists ages ago, and it's a Gestanko scene for those cats now. People are even getting deported. It happened to a Negro lady I knew from the museum, a writer who reviews our shows for the Harlem papers. I didn't even know she was foreign. Evidently, her family came from Trinidad in the 20s when she was a tiny tot. So one day this lady is typing her story on Negro artists. Then the FBI knocks on her door, and she's cooling her heels on Ellis Island. Next stop, Trinidad. You can see why my Puerto Rican pal is worried. You're a foreigner, too. He says to ask if you know some cat in the higher-ups who could help him out. The hell you yell, Asheville has instant coffee now? I might have to come and review the action myself. The boss sends me out on the trail to beat the gums with the Richie Riches, so they'll loan out their Picassos for our big shows. Lately he's been Scobo for the Vanderbilts. So wipe your feet on the mat, cat. I might be headed for your roost. Later, Tom Cuddy.
April 23rd. Dear Mr. Shepherd, your news is extremely welcome. All of us at Stratford & Sons are pleased to know your novel is moving forward at a clip. I've read the chapters you sent and find them in every way up to the standard we expect from our boy Shepherd. This may be your best to date. This contract explains the terms we discussed by telephone. The late summer completion date you suggest will be very suitable. You'll hear soon from our sales department to discuss the title, dust jacket, and so forth. They are determined to include an author photograph this time, so please give the request a fair consideration. I'm afraid your title, the name of this place, does not strike us as quite the ticket. I believe Cataclysm of the Empire has a good ring, but we have time to sort that out. Enclosed herein you will find two copies of the contract for your signature. Attached to the last page, please note the Affidavit of Anti-Communism, also for signature before a notary public. As you may know, this formality is now requisite in all moving picture contracts, and is expected soon to be mandatory in publishing, so we are working to get the necessary papers on file. I send greetings from my Miss Daly, who enjoys her chats with your Mrs. Brown, and cheers from Miss James in the mailing room, who says your letters mount up there as always, fragrant with perfume, despite rumors of your engagement. Many will be gratified to know another of your books will soon be available. Yours sincerely, Lincoln Barnes.
May 4th. Artie proposed breakfast at the Swiss Kitchen, one of his haunts. It seemed to be a tourist place. They had a giant sign out front with a boy in lederhosen. "Food worth yodeling about," and waitresses dressed as milkmaids. Artie, in his ancient cuffed trousers and faint old man smell, was unembarrassed by any of it. "What makes it Swiss food?" I asked, studying the menu. "A lot of grease. Bratwurst. Only here they are going to call it sausage. German food with a strict doctrine of neutrality." With Artie, irony carries the mailbag right to the door of nonchalance. Nothing seems to excite him, short of a revelation that one has worked for Lev Trotsky. Through a haze of burning cigarettes, he studied the new book contract. "These terms are basically good. I'm sorry about the anti-communism business." "I'll sign it. I just hope they won't ask me to disavow anything more difficult."
Such as?
"Coffee with too much sugar. Mad irritation. Plotting murders I could never go through with. That sort of thing."
"These crimes are very difficult to prosecute. Otherwise, all of us except Eleanor Roosevelt would be in the pokey."
One of the waitresses in blonde plaits was making her way toward us, a twin to the one who'd seated us at our window table.
"The pokey," I repeated. "A technical legal term meaning the hoosegow. You're not much a one for American slang, are you? For a young man of words."
"It has never come naturally to me, no. You must hear a lot of it in your business, actors and musicians."
"Oh, yes. From those clients I hear, 'Artie, where is the cabbage?' Clams, dough, moolah, many words for the one thing they don't have these days."
Our milkmaid slipped a pad and pencil from her apron pocket, then dropped the pencil. Deliberately, I could vouch. She knelt to retrieve it, all lowered lashes and ruffled décolletage. The cup runneth over. My stars, as Mrs. Brown would put it. Where do these precious creatures come from? Is it Artie who draws them?
"Dollface, tell us your specials, and promise we will see your face again in 30 seconds when you return with coffee. Extra sugar for my friend."
Yes, it's Artie.
"You have a manner of speaking," he said when she had gone. "The first time we spoke on the phone, I heard it. Every word is perfect, but there is an accent. Like Gary Cooper, not quite the regular apple pie."
"They tell me the same thing in Mexico. My Spanish has a faint accent. I'm the permanent foreigner."
"Well, don't cure it. Your way with words, I mean. We need the income."
"It's not my mother's fault. She was an ace at slang. Flapper, first class. Today is her birthday, by the way. I always took her to lunch."
"Happy birthday, Mrs. Shepherd. How old?"
"Forever young. She died in 38.
"Condolences. How did it happen?"
"A car accident in Mexico City. She was dating a news correspondent. They were racing to the airport to get a look at Howard Hughes."
"Now that is going out with a bang. I mean no disrespect."
"No, you're right. She was all bang. In death as in life. I miss her."
"Now, you mention plotting murders that you cannot find the heart to execute. Is this anything I ought to know about as your legal representative?"
"Just the usual. Newspaper men. The rumors have upset my stenographer this spring. People are treating her badly. Even some of her friends have been callous."
"Now, that is a subject. Freedom of the presses to destroy a person's life for no good reason."
He studied the menu with the same concentration he'd given the book contract, reading all the fine print. When he'd finished, he closed it.
"Congratulations on the new book, by the way. As I said, these are excellent terms. A pretty penny. Now, let me ask you something, a little personal. But I ask in a professional capacity, as the guy whose job is to look out for you and promote the general welfare.
All right, fire away.
I know that Mrs. Brown is not your type, categorically speaking. You once mentioned I am one of a few who knows about this, the Selective Service being another. What I am asking, and I hope the answer is yes, isn't there somebody else who knows?
Somebody. No, not for quite a while. An offer does seem to be on the table right now, but it's not very easy to discuss this, Artie.
He held up a hand, took a sip of his coffee. My intention is not to make you uncomfortable.
You're concerned for my safety?
That you could be put at risk of, shall we say, exposure. Blackmail can arrive from unexpected quarters. I am not speaking in this case of Aware Incorporated. I have had clients in your situation.
Oh, well, no, I don't think that's a worry. This particular friend would have a great deal to lose from exposure, as you say.
Not another Bolshevik. Never mind. Pretend I didn't ask.
I laughed.
No, don't worry. This one is all stars and stripes. We worked together in civilian services during the war, moving paintings into safe storage here from the National Gallery. There were quite a few of us in that corps. You'd be amazed. The art world may never be the same.
Really?
He's working for a museum these days in New York. Out of touch for years, and suddenly now he's coming to town.
It's not easy to contemplate, I'll tell you the truth.
I'd settled pretty well on living as a monk.
Artie waved away a cloud of smoke.
Yeah, me too. I would say, since my wife died, but under oath I would have to say since long before that. Who has the energy?
You might be surprised, Artie. Cocktail waitresses seem to hum around you like little bees.
Entertainment, my friend. Sweet music. In the long run, most of us spend about 15 minutes total in the entanglements of passion, and the rest of our days looking back on it, humming the tune. Not a bad arrangement.
So it seems. He carefully lit a new cigarette from the old one.
Now, love.
Yes. Love is another story.
And this you have in spades, my friend. You are loved by the multitudes, ladies and gents standing in line down the block, waiting for your every word.
Their opinion of me is approximately the same as for a talking pony. Frida said that.
Yes, Artie, I'm very lucky. Employed by the American imagination, as you put it. Long may it wave.
Now I have a question for you, Artie.
Personal?
No. This friend in New York tells me foreigners are being deported there for suspicion of just about anything, working for Negro rights and so forth. My friend is dramatic. He can exaggerate.
Your friend in this case does not exaggerate.
That's diabolical. To bolster support by deporting the opposition?
Diabolical is a polite term for this behavior.
Are they setting their caps mostly for non-citizens?
Mr. Hoover and Mr. Watkins at the INS are becoming very enthusiastic with their house cleaning. Some of the deportees have been living in this country since Homer was a pup. A fellow I know of, Williamson, Labor Secretary of the Communist Party, currently held without bond on Ellis Island, accused of being an immigrant. He says he was born in San Francisco. 45 years of age, he has family, witnesses. But all the birth certificates in that city were lost in the earthquake and fire of 06.
Goodness.
Shepherd, you have a birth certificate, do you not?
I do. It was some trouble with both parents dead, but I located the hospital. I have both passports, U.S. and Mexican. I had to sort it out during the war, as you'd guess, called up to work for the Department of State. They like to see credentials.
Keep that U.S. passport with your guns and liquor. That is my advice.
Breakfast was biscuits and gravy, sausages and eggs on many heavy white plates. Artie rearranged it all to make room for his ashtray and continued smoking right through the meal. With so much grease everywhere, I wondered about spontaneous combustion. "Mrs. Brown does her best to keep me out of trouble," I said. "She claims my ideology is transparent, but no criminal record as yet."
"Who needs crimes? The INS has a stable of witnesses, professionals, very well paid, very talented. They can produce a testimony for any occasion. If a man is not a communist, they'll prove he is. If he is, they can get him booked for creating confusion and hysteria to hold him until CP membership becomes illegal."
"Outlaw a political party? What kind of country does that?"
"The kind in which you reside. The party has disavowed violence, as you know. Last year, they also severed all ties with the Information Bureau of the Soviet Union to be on the safe side. Turns out, there is no safe side. A federal grand jury just declared that Communist Party membership is a threat to the civilian defense. Now Congress is working on the Mundt-Nixon bill, requiring members to enter their names in a registry. So, denying CP membership will soon be a crime also. These people are damned if they do, and damned if they do not."
Outside in the parking lot under the restaurant's jolly billboard, that yodeling boy in his lederhosen, a dark-colored auto pulled in, and a couple emerged from it, in the throes of a terrible argument. The plate glass window shut out any sound, but their rage was visible. The man kept circling the woman to shout at her face, and she kept turning away, her loose raincoat swinging like a bell, her flat shoes stepping side to side. A child peered from the oval of the auto's rear window, the small, doomed fish in the bowl. "Well, Artie, at least I'm no party member."
"Mr. Shepherd, you have a colorful past. Your Mexican friends, do they stay in touch?"
"Frida does, Mrs. Kahlo, intermittently. She's just joined up again with the Communist Party after a lapse. She says it's all going strong there."
"So it may be, and legal also in her locale. But I suggest discretion."
"You're not saying I should simply cut off old friends for fear of association?"
"No, I am not, and I recognize you, sir, as a man with a spinal column. But you would be amazed at the number of people who do exactly what you've said."
"I see. My stenographer would say, fairly warned is fair afeared."
"That is about the sum of what I can offer you, yes."
"So, keeping old letters and so forth in the house, maybe not a good idea?"
"A man with a spinal column and a brain. Bravo! Now, what about our friend Agent X, who came calling last October? Does he also keep in touch?"
"Not another peep. He must have discovered what a lackluster stiff I am."
"Maybe. We should all be so lucky. But these men don't care who you are. Not even what you're planning to do, despite what they may say. They're like bloodhounds. What gets them baying is the whiff of where you have already been."
"Well, that can't change. I spent years around communists, cleaning their dishes while they deliberated the transitional program and formalized party directives. You know something, Artie? They eat what people eat. They paint the dining room yellow and love their children. I keep wondering, what have people got against communists?"
"I told you, anti-communism is not very much concerned with communism."
"So you said. Tuna fish and the Spanish influenza. It's hard to believe."
"Think of religion. A virgin birth. Likewise hard to believe. Yet taken by many as evidence that purveyors of indecency are everywhere."
The arguing couple outside got back in their car and drove away, a stop on their journey.
"Communism. Most people have no idea what it is," Artie said. I do not exaggerate. Look around this restaurant. Ask any of these fine citizens. Excuse me, sir, I've been thinking of an idea. A bunch of working people owning the means of their own production. What do you make of that? You know, he might be all for it.
Communism is the same as Stalin. That's what he thinks.
Correct. And baseball is 9 white men and a stick. Seeing is believing. For years, the president told us we had no fear. They put up signs to that effect in every post office. Tojo doesn't scare us. Now, we have a change of program. They're plastering up a new slogan, Run Like Hell.
I see what you mean.
According to Elmo Roper's last poll, 40% of Americans believe the Jews have too much power in this country. Tell me, we have how many Jewish men in the Congress?
Not many, I shouldn't think. Maybe none at all.
So, what is the problem? Foreign-sounding people, not Christian and not apologetic about it. They may have their own ideas. It suggests a challenge to our hard-earned peace and bounty. Making a fuss over Negro segregation would be another example.
I see that. The issue is not communism per se. He leaned forward, his blue eyes watery, feverish-looking. He held up both hands as if he meant to clasp my face between them.
You know what the issue is? Do you want to know? It's what these guys have decided to call America. They have the audacity to say, There, you sons of bitches, don't lay a finger on it. That is a finished product.
But, Artie, any country is still in the making, always. That's just history. People have to see that.
He dropped his hands, sat back against the booth. Pardon my French, but tell it to the goddamn Marines.
My stenographer said the same thing, more or less, minus the French. Artie had finished his breakfast and now stacked up plates, ashtray on top, recovering himself.
You're Mrs. Brown, a very astute lady. How is she?
Astute, as you say. And not mine, for the record. She's all right, I think.
Good.
He ground out his cigarette, smoothed the contract on the table, and folded it into its envelope.
You can sign this, affidavit and all, if that's what you want. I can't say yes or no. But I'm going to tell you something about history in the making. Remember, you heard this first from Artie Gold over a plate of groundhog and cackle. This is going to get serious. What these men are doing could become permanent.
What do you mean?
Suddenly he looked weary. You force people to stop asking questions, and before you know it, they have auctioned off the question mark or sold it for scrap. No boldness. No good ideas for fixing what's broken in the land. Because if you happen to mention it's broken, you are automatically disqualified.
Surely that's overstating it, I said. America runs on extremes. The latest craze in a tank of gas will get you about anywhere. Today, the Kremlin is a messianic movement and you're better dead than red. Tomorrow, they'll decide the real mischief is cigarettes and sugar in your coffee. The culture is built on hyperbole. I wanted to see him smile.
Or maybe you really do think this food is worth yodeling about.
He didn't smile.
I'm an old man. I've seen a lot. But what these men are doing is putting poison on the lawn. It kills your crabgrass, all right. And then you have a lot of dead stuff out there for a very long time. Maybe forever.
The Asheville Trumpet, June 18, 1948. City Slams Doors on Polio Menace by Carl Nicholas.
The City Health Commission this week banned all public gatherings to stem the tide of infantile paralysis sweeping our state. The quarantine began at 1 a.m. Monday, closing movie houses, skating parlors, swimming pools, and other public sites of infestation. All city churches except the Roman Catholic have sensibly urged their flocks to pray from the safety of home. This city of 50,000 souls is quiet as a grave, as housewives stay home from shopping, and our businesses and resorts see profits stolen by the epidemic. Dr. Ken Malusa, interviewed at the health department by telephone, reminded us that even the wisest of medical men can offer no chemical cure for polio. This germ is crafty. You won't see him with the human eye or even the best microscopes. Many have given it a try, but the sneaky fellow won't show his face. Penicillin doesn't scare him. It's no use at all. My advice is, keep the kiddies away from the crowds where he travels. That goes for men and ladies, too. No one's in the clear. 7% of hapless victims die, says Dr. Malusa, and nearly all are crippled. The good doctor said no explanation accounts for the epidemics each year, which occur in summer only. Asheville is presently suffering the worst rate of epidemic in our nation, in a state that already this year has seen more than 1,000 victims fall to the polio menace. The national total is nearly 6,000. The town fathers have composed a letter to Bishop Vernon Reynolds in Raleigh, urging him to grant permission to Roman Catholics here to remain away from their rites.
July 6th. Dear Frida, it's 2 in the morning and bright as day outside. The paved street has a watery shine, with the trees lined up along both banks like the canals of Xochimilco. The moon is not quite full. Perfect down the left side, but a little ragged on the right, so waning. Sea for Cristo means it is dying away. I couldn't sleep tonight, so sat up to meet our birthday. But I must have fallen into a dream for a few seconds, because you were here in my room just now, in your wheelchair, your hair all done up, working at an easel with your back to me. I said, Frida, look, the streets have turned to rivers. Let's take a boat somewhere. You turned to me with empty eye sockets and said, You go on, Soli. I have to stay. The radio news may have put me off sleep. Stalin's blockade of Berlin is a horror, and not so difficult for us to imagine here. Asheville is also under siege, quarantined because of the polio. Today I walked downtown to put Mrs. Brown's wage in the bank, and I saw not one other living soul on the way. The school playgrounds, empty. The luncheonettes, dark. Their counters attended by lines of empty chrome stools. The city is a graveyard. My only compatriots today were the plaster models in the store windows, with their smug blind eyes and smart attire. Of course, the bank was closed. I can imagine you here, Frida, limp skipping through the streets to have a laugh at all this fear. You've already had the polio. You have your leg to show for it, your billowing woe and passion that can't be chased indoors for anything. It's a gift to survive death, isn't it? It puts us outside the fray. How strange that I include myself. I wonder now what I mean. What was my childhood disease? Love, I suppose. I was susceptible to contracting great love, suffering the chills and delirium of that pox. But it seems I am safe now, unlikely to contract it again. The advantages of immunity are plain. People contort themselves around the terror of being alone, making any compromise against that. It's a great freedom to give up on love and get on with everything else. Mainly this summer, my everything else is the new book. I believe it will be serious, Frida, and worthy. But at any rate, finished soon, in autumn, I hope. I proceed at a sluggish pace because I have to do all my own retyping.
Mrs. Brown's efficiency has spoiled me, and now she can't come to work because her landlady is hysterical over the epidemic. She threatened the boarders that if they go out in public or ride the buses, they aren't welcome back in the house. Mrs. Brown tolerates the intolerable from that woman. Stalin himself could learn from the siege of Mrs. Biddle. I have wondered, why shouldn't I let Mrs. Brown live here? We already work together. I have an empty bedroom. You see, I am dumb as a calf, trying to divine the rules about such things. In Mexico, all manner of people could live in one house, half carrying hearts on their sleeves and the other half carrying sidearms, all rolled in one chalupa. But no, not here. Even a dumb calf gains a dim understanding after enough blows to the head. We would be hung out as filthy laundry in Echo and Star Week. Children would be instructed to cross to the opposite side of the street to pass the house. Luckily, the mail remains under control. Mrs. Brown organized for it all to come to Mrs. Biddle's until and unless the landlady realizes the menace of an envelope licked by a stranger. My house is as empty as the luncheonettes. Mrs. Brown's table tidy as she left it. Typewriter under a dust cover. Telephone standing like a black daffodil blooming from the table, its earpiece dangling. If I want company, I can sift through the mail. She forwards it all here in boxes after she has answered it. Those letters continue to astonish. The flow has hardly slowed. Now the girls all beg, "Please, Mr. Shepherd, give us a happy ending next time." As if I held sway over anything real with my invented puppets. These girls have bet on a dark horse. No one should count on me for a happy outcome. You and I are the same. Do people ask you to erase the bleeding hearts and daggers from your paintings to make them more jolly? But Mexico is different, I know that. You're allowed your hearts and daggers there. Our Christmas visit sustains my memories, though it's true what you said. You have become a different person. I won't agree, however, that you are a bag of bones. Diego is a fool. That skinny lizard Maria Felix should run up a tree and eat ants. But your health does worry me, I'll be honest. One thing that kept me sitting up tonight is the dread that I may not celebrate many more birthdays with you. More than anything, I regret the cross words during our visit. I understand your temper, that it's a kind of poetry rather than actual truth, and that you and Mrs. Brown were not apt to get along perfectly. You and she are both important women in my life, and too many cooks will put a fire in the kitchen. If any forgiving is to be done, Mrs. Brown and I have already done it. I'm certain she would send her greetings with mine. Abrazos to Diego, and to Candelaria, Belén, Carmen Alba, Perpetua, Alejandro, and everyone else in your house, where I seem to have more friends than in the entire city where I now live. But most of all, to you, mi querida, feliz cumpleaños. July 30th. Mrs. Brown called before 9 this morning, beside herself. A second letter from the scorpion at the loyalty firm, Lauren Mattis. An incriminating photograph, he claims, but it makes no sense at all. I made her read that part of the letter twice. A photo of Harrison Shepherd and his wife at a Communist Party meeting in 1930. I'm to pay him a fee of $500 for the chance to examine it. She took a letter over the phone. Why this photograph could not be what he says. In 1930, Harrison Shepherd was 14 years of age, attending an elementary school for the mentally damaged in Mexico City. His political leaning was to collect centipedes in a jar and set them loose under Señora Bartolomé's desk during the prayers. Since that year, he has discovered no reason to marry, nor has anyone signed on for the job,
but it might have quite entertained him to have a wife in 1930. A lot of people might pay money to see that. Signed sincerely, Harrison Shepherd, HS/VB. August 11th. Advance the spark, says Tom Cuddy on the phone. Square Olina, here I come. He has museum business with the Vanderbilts. We'll be staying 3 nights at the Grove Park. Proposes we meet there. An assignation, he calls it. Oh, Tom, Tom, vanity's son, expecting me to show up with hat in hand, heart pounding, knowing, in fact, I will. The assignation. Long time no see, says the handsome scoundrel, looking up from his highball. The firm handshake, the chair pulled out. The terrace restaurant at the Grove Park is very grand. White cloths on the tables and candles flickering, but all other chairs were empty. Tom must have been the only guest in the hotel. You're brave letting your boss send you here. Have they not heard about our quarantine in Manhattan? Or are you all just so dashing the plague can't catch up? Who's afraid of a little polio germ, he said. Builds up the character. Tommy, that's no joke. What's your poison? This is a slow gin fizz. Don't let the name throw you, it's a fast ticket. The apron back there at the bar has a heavy foot. All right, a ticket on the fast train, please. Tommy signaled the waiter, who hovered constantly nearby in the dark, either at the patio entrance or over by the wall, sneaking a smoke. I have wondered if waiters will ever become invisible to me as they seem to be for others. I wanted to help this lad out, go get the drinks myself, and later help him carry the plates to the kitchen. Tommy's cigarette end glowed, constantly in motion. Oh, come on, look what the polio did for FDR. A gimp leg gets you the sympathy vote. You can be maudlin as anything, and they all go dotty for it. I hate the war. Eleanor hates the war. Our little dog Fala hates the war. The drinks appeared, followed by dinner, materializing from the dark, just as Tom had, unreal as the image rising in a movie house. Cruelty is just a role he plays, like Herd Hatfield as Dorian Gray. Tommy has seen some damage in his day. The modern show he helped curate, ridiculed by Congress, he took that personally. And that's probably the least of it, for a boy who wants so madly to belong and will not quite. The truth of Tommy is slow to rise, but he is down there somewhere, underneath the shining surface. The day we first met, sitting on a crate of Rodin in the train, he dropped the clever banner along with his jaw upon hearing the name Rivera. He has studied those murals in photographs. He wanted to know everything, the mixture of plaster, the pigments. And Frida, how she laid the paint on, with brushes or knives, the warm or cool colors first. That unearthly sadness that radiates from her paintings. Does she feel it herself when she's painting? Those were his words, unearthly sadness. Tommy has handled 2 Kahlos already in his time at the museum. Later on, in his room, lying on our backs smoking his herd of camels one after another, shirtless in the dark, it could have been the Potomac Academy or the tiny barracks at Lev's. But those places couldn't have contained him. Tom Cuddy is a one-man band. His questions don't need answers. It's hard enough just to work out what he's asking. Who would win at arm wrestling, Frankie Lane or Perry Como? Has Christian Dior gone screwball or hopped on the genius wagon? Why? What's Dior done? Took all the padding off the girls' shoulders and stuffed it in their brassieres. He is thinking of leaving the gallery, the art world altogether, for advertising. What, Tommy, to write jingles? Lucky strike means fine tobacco? No, you egg. Art direction, creating the look of tomorrow.
I thought the museum was what you loved. Kandinsky and Edward Hopper. Now you want to be Llewellyn Evans in The Hucksters, selling beauty soap to unsuspecting housewives?
Not soap, glamour. Sex, God, and the patriarch.
Tommy blew a meticulous smoke ring, watched it rise toward the ceiling.
On the seventh day, Tom Cuddy made America, and Tom Cuddy said, "Cat, that is good."
If I were a religious man, I'd get off this bed before lightning strikes it.
One day you will see, Shepherd, my friend, the men campaigning for president are going to hire advertisers.
Tommy, you've lost your marbles.
This is no fish. Do you know how many television stations there are now?
6 or 7, I guess.
20.
How's your friend, by the way, the Latin Romeo with the face for television? The question shifted Tom's mood, turning him petulant. Ramiro is gone, not to Puerto Rico, but out of the city, far from the glamorous spotlight. Maybe selling brushes door to door. It was hard to avoid speculating on the clockwork of Tom Cuddy's universe. Ramiro's setting sun, the rising star of Harrison Shepherd. The long compromise against loneliness. Tom says he'll be back here in a month, and probably more times after that. To Cashville, as he calls it. Regular assignations on expense account at the Grove Park, as long as he continues to happify the Vanderbilts as planned.
"You're lucky you live here," he said.
"What, in Square Olina, under a quarantine?"
"Well, here, Shep, or any damn place you want. Writing what you want, with nobody watching over your shoulder. In the city, we're like ants under a lens, getting scorched in the sun."
"Scorched ants? That's dramatic."
I pushed myself up off the bed. It took some effort, a lot of slow gin under the bridge, but I needed to pace the little room.
Tommy's energy came off his skin like electricity. I stood by the window, a porthole into the dark.
"I'm dramatic," he said. "You should hear the real gory. The Joes in radio and television, the producers are like those little brutes in grammar school, crowding around to watch the ant fry. Conspiracy indictments, alien hearings. Do you know how many New Yorkers are from someplace? The city's going to be as empty as this hotel."
In a rare turn of events, he seemed to have run out of words. I could hear the place breathing, the gasp of roof beams, the slow circulation of water through pipes. Tommy lit another Camel.
"They don't even have to indict you. One day you just feel the heat and you know they're up there, kneeling in the circle, watching you writhe. Your name has gone on a list. Everybody stops talking when you come into a room. You think we don't know about the plague?"
"They're only television producers, Tommy. Not heads of state with secret police at their disposal. Just men who get up in the morning, put on Sears Roebuck suits, and go to an office to decide who gets a pie in the face today. It's hard to feature how they could be so monstrous."
"Hard to feature."
Tom clucked his tongue, whether at a writer's prose or his innocence, who could say?
"Little shepherd boy, what am I going to do with you?"